You're listening to an RN Breakfast special, Ellen Fanning with you on this Boxing Day. This half hour, we're taking you back to three of our favourite interviews from 2014. Australian music legend Ian Molly Meldrum began his memoir back in 1979, but it wasn't until he fell off a ladder and nearly died in 2011 that he felt he needed to finish it. Earlier this year, he caught up with Fran.
Way back when I was doing The Countdown and I started working for TV Week as a columnist, because I was always late and la la la, they got someone to help me ghostwrite it, which was a guy called Laurie Marston, who played for my time, but worked with TV Week, right? And he came with the idea, let's document some of this, right? So we started not as a book, and it went on and on and on and on, you know, talking tapes and whatever like that. And there's a lot in that, I guess.
I want to come to the Countdown years. It's a terrific read, and for someone like me who grew up with Countdown, it just brings it all flooding back. I can actually remember a lot of the clips you describe here. But, Molly, we should go to the fact that we nearly lost you back in 2011 when you were putting up those Christmas decorations and you fell off the ladder, and you did, you know, you came close to death. And the country went in to shock. There was a huge reaction to that. For you, I'm sure, the greatest challenge of your life coming back from that. What did that change in the way you felt about life, your friends, and your country, given the response?
Now that you put it that way, that week that it happened, I was having the normal Christmas party at home, and I have all my friends over on Christmas Day night after I've been out for Christmas lunch with Michael Sigurdinski or the Foxes, and I always have one at home for my friends that don't really have a Christmas and all that, so we're getting ready for all of that. On the Tuesday leading up to that, I went to a Sade concert at the Rod Laver Stadium in Melbourne, and I did an interview with Sade, and then I stood there watching the concert, and then I got an urgent phone call on my phone, and I saw with the red thing, I went, what's going on wrong here? So I answered it. And what happened was that my partner in Thailand, Jan, had involved that day in a terrible car accident where one person was killed in the accident and another one was injured, and so was Jan. So I left the concert, apologised that I had to leave, and went back home on the Tuesday night. And then I thought, right, I'm going to have to put off this Christmas thing. On Wednesday morning, I rang Thai Airlines and said, look, can you get me a flight? I want to go to Thailand straight away, right? And they said, well, we'll get one for you on Friday. And then on Thursday, probably, I was trying to cope with everything and wasn't quite myself. Then I came home and I just wanted to check to see some of the decorations that we had bought were up. And I went up the ladder. It had been raining and, put it crudely, I went arse over tit and crashed down onto the ground on the concrete and the border around the Egyptian spa pool, whatever. And I just went unconscious. Mm. And luckily Joe, that looks after the house, he was there, and he does paramedics, and he knew how to get my head up and rang the ambulance. And I was unconscious, and literally unconscious for 5 weeks. And then when I finally came to, and they were transferring me from the Alfred to the Epworth for rehab, everything started hitting me like, you know, flowers and cards and emails and everything. And it was so overwhelming. I didn't quite know how to handle it, you know. I'm still very shy at times and I didn't know what to do. I'm forever grateful to the Alfred and to the Epworth and to the Australian public and the press and I think
everyone is very grateful too to all of those, and because you're still with us. And I have to say, from reading this book, Molly, there's nothing wrong with your memory, despite that terrible, terrible accident.
Well, on that subject, when Professor Jeff Rosenfeld, who's the top neurologist here at the Alfred, and he was explaining to him that, you know, this was fine and my memory was fine, my brain was fine. And my brother Brian and Yale looked at each other and one of them said, God, I hope he remembers he's gay, for God's sake. We're going to go through all that again, for God's sake. He did say that.
All right, well, I'm not going to ask you to check on that, but I'm presuming everything's fine in that department. Molly, let's go to a couple of stories about
my mind or being gay? Both.
Both, about the Countdown days. But a lot of people have made reference to the fact that you were the antithesis of what you'd expect to see on a rock and roll TV show host. You weren't slick. As Deborah Conway said once, the antithesis of slick. He was inarticulate, clumsy, not very well-groomed, always in awe, which kind of gave him a very tenuous hold over the interview. That was very lovable. But as you read the book, there's a great story in there about your pre-Countdown days when you were working in London and you came face to face with John Lennon. You were so in awe, you fell off your chair, you threw the drink over him. But then later, John Lennon gave you a scoop, told you the story about the Beatles breaking up, and you were so overwhelmed by being in his presence, you hadn't even heard what he'd told you. You didn't even know you had the scoop.
You're absolutely right. And back then, long before emails and the internet and whatever, I dutifully sent that tape back to Melbourne to go set. And then, which was also rare for kid phone calls, I get the boss of Go Set, Phil Fraser, ring me, and he said, you didn't tell us about the Beatles breaking up. And I said, what do you mean the Beatles are breaking up? Where'd you get that from? And he said, it's in your interview, you bloody idiot. And sure enough, he'd given me the scoop, and I didn't realise it myself.
And that's a part of the secret of Molly Meldrum, isn't it? You're a bit of a groupie.
I am a groupie. And I'm not a journalist, obviously, because to miss on that, well, I didn't miss out on it because we became a world scoop around the world, and Melody Maker, God, they all picked it up.
Molly Meldrum, Countdown, as you tell it, was really an accidental success too. It was only meant to last 6 weeks originally, See How You Went.
Mm-hmm.
It lasted 13 years, and it really put a lot of bands on the map. In Australia, if a band was featured on Countdown, time after time, it went to number one and had that much power. In fact, some thought too much power, didn't it?
Well, I never liked the word power. I never have in my life, for a start. And the fact is that with Countdown and with Michael Shrimpton, who was my boss, and Robbie Weeks, who helped create it with us, we're a team. And if it hadn't been for that amazing team, then it would never have happened. I had to do a thing down at Elswick at the studios a few weeks ago. And I just sat in the studio waiting for them to set up. And I just looked around and I thought, my God, you know, because it was a team. And without a team, I was just...
It was a team, but it's also pretty clear in here that you drove the talent for the show. You were the one who said, hey, look at this ABBA, they're really good, mm-hmm. Let's play this. And ABBA went to number one in Australia before it went to another one in other companies.
Yeah.
I mean, you have an eye for a pop talent, don't you?
Well, maybe that, but it's still the team. There's stories in that book that cover about, you know, Midnight Oil coming out, arriving late for a start, which was unheard of because it held every other act up for rehearsals on the Saturday, and then wanted them, insisted that they use their sound guy, and we explained we can't do that, you know, because if we had it, we would have had an actual strike in our hands, you know, and they didn't understand that, so they took the joy then that they never did a Countdown, you know. I just thought that was ridiculous, you know, and maybe, happy ready for this one, maybe Peter Garrett should have stuck in another job that apparently he's very good at, of insulation and...
That's enough. Molly Meldrum, we could talk for ages. There's a million stories
insulation,
in this.
Insulation, I said, because it's hopeless.
Do you remind
me then of my school teacher.
Is that right?
When I would open my mouth and look very sternly at him and go,
stop.
No, enough is enough.
That's exactly right, Molly Meldrum. Do you have a favourite Countdown memory?
I do. It's when we started putting it together, because I was doing a kids show back then as well, on Channel 7, and I raced up for our first broadcast, and watching it, and Gordon French's, who was the boss of Channel 7 down here, in his office, and watching it go to air in colour was something I'll never forget in my life. That was my magic moment. And as Barry Humphries, as Dame Edna would say, it had colour and movement, and we gave it.
It certainly had that. Molly Meldrum, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on the book. It is, for someone of my generation who the Countdown years were absolutely front and centre, it's a terrific read. But I'm sure for everybody too, it's a terrific history of the Australian rock and roll industry. It's got the political sort of aura of the time in there. It's the history of TV as well. Thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the interview. And you don't remind me of my school teacher because you're far more pretty than that. And you did have that stern look when I was talking about Peter Garrett.
All right, at this time we won't name the teacher right at this moment. Molly Meldrum, thank you.
Thank you.
Molly Meldrum speaking there to Fran Kelly. And Molly's book, The Never, Ever Ending Story, is published by Allen and Unwood. You're listening to an RN Breakfast special on this Boxing Day. I'm Ellen Fanning. Well, it's won pretty much every musical award you can think of. And now Matilda the Musical, based on the book by Roald Dahl, is coming to Australia. The music and lyrics belong to Australian performer Tim Minchin, who joined James Carlton in the studio.
And when I grow up, I will eat sweets every day. I will go to bed late every night. And I will wake up when the sun comes up, and I will watch cartoons until my eyes go square. And I won't care, 'cause I'll be all grown up when I grow up.
Just some of the music from Matilda the Musical. Roald Dahl, story of a precocious and ever so slightly magical young girl. It's captured the hearts of children. It's playing in Australia for the first time in musical form from July next year. The music and lyrics belong to the Australian performer Tim Minchin, who's back at home, back in the country, to launch the musical's Australian premiere season. With me in the studio, Tim Minchin, welcome to Breakfast.
Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm very well.
Good.
Cast your mind back 10 years ago. You were a struggling musician. Now you're back with an international Broadway West End hit. What was the middle 10 years like?
Oh, it's been a pretty crazy 10 years, actually. The 10 years before were, well, really good fun, but slightly impecunious and sometimes a bit desperate. But the 10 years since I turned 30 have just been a constant surprise, really, and I've got to do all the things I thought I wouldn't be allowed to do in my 20s.
And yet you seem to have taken Rudyard Kipling's advice to treat triumph and disaster as imposters. It doesn't go to your head.
Well, I wish. I wish I could be Rudyard's ideal man, but it's an effort to... Well, I don't know if it's an effort to not let things go to your head. I think that's just to do with how you're brought up, sort of thing. But it is, it doesn't get any easier to sort of, he talks about if you can, I can't remember the quote now. I'm looking for the slings and arrows bit, but I'm drifting to Hamlet. But, you know, I think it doesn't get any easier to sort of negotiate criticism and adoration. And, you know, your ego is a sensitive thing, but I you work on it, you know.
Do you? Are you, as they say in Los Angeles, grounded, which I used to think referred to airlines?
Yeah, well, the grounded on an airline is bad and on a person is good, which
is good.
Interesting.
It's very confusing.
You need wings. I'm married to the girl I met when I was 17, and I had kids coming before anyone started taking any notice of me, so my priorities are pretty clear to me.
It works that way, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Putting this story on stage has been a dream of yours for a long time?
Well, it's just a lovely, slightly weird coincidence that about 13 years ago when I was writing children's theatre in Perth, I wrote to the Dahl Estate to inquire about the rights for Matilda because I thought it would make a great children's musical. And that, like many ideas from those days, kind of came and went and didn't happen. And then in 2009, I went into this meeting and they said, "Have you heard of Matilda?" And I went, "Yeah." Have you ever thought about writing music for theatre? And I said, "Yeah, that's what I did for 10 years before I became a comedian." So it was fate.
Fate, well.
Yeah, it must be fate.
It must
be.
There's
no other explanation.
An invisible hand at play.
That's right.
Guiding you.
Who thinks I'm important?
We'll get to your scepticism a little bit later because you're being sarcastic. But there's a certain quality to Dahl's writing, the darkness. I reckon he captures kids because he doesn't patronise. Is that something that you've...
Yeah, I think that's a huge thing for him. He was a very interesting man. I would have loved to have met him, but he did have a talent of treading the tightrope between comedy and tragedy in a very unique way, and that was something we tried to capture.
And as a father, you'll know there's no one who walks that tightrope between comedy and tragedy more often and more profoundly than children.
That's right, and they totally understand it, and they're not... That they have fear, but they're not scared in the way we think they're scared. And I don't think we always get it right when we're trying to protect them from things. And Dahl never condescended to them. He sort of identified weirdly, even though he was a grumpy man with a great deal of pain in his life, both physical and emotional. He saw himself as a kid. And there's no doubt that getting that right was our main aim. And there's also no doubt that we succeeded in creating a musical that doesn't condescend to anyone, children or adults. I can't speak about how good the musical is, but I think we got that right.
Well, I think the awards, various awards around the world have spoken to how good it is, plus the fans in the West End and Broadway, and the fact that when you walk the streets, you sometimes will hear children singing your songs from the musical. What does that feel like?
Yeah, especially in London, after it opened on the West End a couple of years ago, the subsequent summers have been filled with children's kind of musical theatre camps and kids in school singing these songs, and it's incredibly nice to have any of your work received well, but also for it to live beyond me. As a solo artist, of course, if I'm not there playing it, it doesn't exist. Whereas to have a piece of work that I'm proud of and that I hasten to add that I only played a small part in, with an amazing collaborative piece of work, to have it...
As all musical theatre is.
Yeah, and it has to, and that's why it's so hard to get right. It requires so many people to be at the top of their game. To have that sitting there in the West End and on Broadway, and knowing that every night there's, you know, some thousands of people of all ages being affected by it, it's an incredible idea. You really feel like you've contributed something to culture rather than just being a foul-mouthed kind of cynic on the stage every now and then.
Well, they could be related.
Yeah. I think
sides of the same coin.
Yeah. I think there's cultural contributions to be made by comedy. Definitely. I think society is led by comedians in some way, but it's a slightly dirtier, sort of muckier kind of contribution.
What's next for you? Is it true that you're working on a musical adaptation of Groundhog Day?
Yeah. Can you imagine it?
You really picked the easy ones, hanging fruit.
Yeah. Groundhog Day as a musical has been a sort of idea in the world for a while. In about 10 years ago, the New York Times reported that Sondheim was going to have a crack at it, which is slightly apocryphal because he never quite, I think they didn't settle on the rights. But I spoke to Sondheim about it, and he's very interested in it and told me, he said, I couldn't crack it. And I think he meant that in lots of ways. It's not an easy text to turn into a musical, but at the same time, what he identified and what I believe is that it's perfect as a theatrical piece. It's a bit like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, the Stoppard, which I got to do last year here in Sydney, in that they are characters trapped in a play they don't understand, and they have to try and figure out how to negotiate this world. And of course, a theatre is perfect for that because they're trapped on a stage. You know, all the world's a stage and we have players in it. And Groundhog Day has a similar thing. Is a man trapped in a scenario, and it might as well be actors revolving around him. It's just that they don't know they're doing the same play every day.
Yes. But a musical is another challenge altogether.
But then you got to get Phil singing. Yeah. But I've written most of it. Danny Rubin, who wrote the film, is writing it with me, and Matthew Warchus, who directed Matilda, is doing his amazing architectural job. And it's funny, and it's nerve-wracking, but it's looking okay, and there's a hell of a lot of room for very dark humour and to go further down the philosophical laneways that the premise throws up.
Yeah, which the movie didn't quite do so much of.
Well, it stayed, part of its genius was it managed to be deep and a rom-com.
Shallow.
Yeah, managed to be deep and shallow. It's like me in that regard. But the musical, the form of a musical allows you to explore that. Just like Matilda is much deeper than the book and is made for adults as well as children, which isn't to say it's better. It's just the form allows you to probe deeper into the subplot. You know?
Exactly, and give different things to different audiences.
That's
and
exactly right.
Does Bill Murray sing?
Bill Murray doesn't sing, and one of our major challenges is going, and I think it's actually easy to do, you just have to be brave about it, is to within the first 10 minutes turn the audience's brain from the movie. And also remember that, you know, this is a 22-year-old movie. You can't assume the audience has seen it, nor do you want to. The young audiences won't necessarily know the movie, so you just need to... You know, our Phil will be nothing like Bill Murray. He can't be.
Yeah, yeah. You are, I mentioned this before, a very keen skeptic. You're very pro-science. You're very anti-homeopathy, anti-so-called alternate medicine. What do you make of the fact that in Australia, the more educated you are and the wealthier you are, the more likely you are not to be immunised, the more likely you are to use homeopathy?
Yeah, well, there's quirks. There's an inverse correlation between education and religious belief, as in the more you learn, the less you're likely to have religious belief, although there's great exceptions, especially in this state where there's very, very powerful churches that have very strong connections in business and stuff. So there's quite a lot of religion in New South Wales all the way up. And then there's this other group of, and it happens, I live in LA now and it's massive, the anti-vaccine mob, which is a peculiar function of our era where there's just massive amounts of information. And even if you're very well educated, it's hard to know what information you should be reading. And I will always fall on the side of the data. But people are much more able to respond to narrative than data. And it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor or educated or not.
People say your faith is the data, your religion is the data, and you just happen to have a different religion to them.
Yeah, that's a misinterpretation of the notion of faith, I think. That's a sort of relativism. And
faith is distinct from observation. In other words, you're very willing to accept that you're wrong about homeopathy.
Yeah,
you're just waiting for the evidence.
Yeah, I would love to see some data. I have that poem, which is quite well known, that's just about to come out as a book called Storm, that has the line, which is quite strong, but the line is faith is...
This is not going to be the one about the penis, is
No, faith is the denial of observation. So science adjusts its belief based on what's observed. Faith is the denial of observation so that belief can be preserved. And it sort of says everything I think about that.
I shouldn't have interjected, because there's later on a bit where you go on about...
Oh, there's lots of swearing, but that's not for morning radio. Hello, audience of Radio National.
Family. James Randi is one of the great skeptics of the world. You once received an unsolicited email from him, is this
right? Yeah, I think it was off the back of a song I wrote called If You Open Your Mind Too Much, Your Brain Will Fall Out, open bracket, take my wife, close bracket, which was a quote stolen out of Francis Ween's rather scathing book, How Mumbo Jumbo Conquered the World. And James liked that song because it basically was a bet in which I promised someone who could scientifically prove, among other things, that homeopathy works, that I would give them one of my legs and my piano and my wife.
So do you remember what you said in your reply to him, to your email?
Oh, yeah. Well, James wrote saying, you know, I love that song and, you know, good work. And I said, oh, This is like George Bush getting an email from Jesus, which is a little overblown because although James is a very interesting and smart man and a real activist for a sort of non-superstitious worldview, I don't like the notion of heroes and icons. I think that's dangerous. You're only going to be disappointed.
So you're grounded.
Just got to be careful of putting people on pedestals, because people are always people. And if you should take, I believe, and I wonder, I think you probably agree with me that there are wonderful people in the world. But if you try and turn them into messiahs, then you'll be really sad when it turns out they're dirty simians like we are, you know.
Australian musician Tim Minchin speaking to James Carlton. Ellen Fanning with you on this Boxing Day. Now to one of your favourite interviews of the past few weeks. Tessa Kum is far from a household name, but she started a huge movement in the wake of the Sydney siege. Inspired by other acts of generosity she'd read about on social media, Tessa Kum invited anyone wearing religious attire who was afraid for their safety to ride alongside her on public transport. In an emotional interview, I spoke to her about the success of her hashtag, I'll ride with you.
Hi there, thank you.
I saw your tweet come through. Just tell me, what made you post it?
It was very much a sort of breaking point for me, I saw another tweet online just indicating another woman's act of kindness, and I simply felt that there needed to be more of that in the world.
What had Rachel Jacobs, that's the woman who committed that act of kindness, what had she done, what had happened, and how did she react?
She had done a very simple thing. She had seen a distressed Muslim woman on a train take off her hijab and had approached that woman at the train station and simply said, put it back on, I'll walk with you. And that broke my heart a little bit, yeah.
You're feeling very emotional, like a lot of people in Australia and around the world. You've been watching these events on TV overnight. But that simple act of kindness that touched you, yeah?
Very much so. Nobody should have to live like that.
Mm. And so tell me, what did you post? What did you say that has caused 120,000 people to say, yes, what she said? I'll say what she said. What did you say?
120,000 people, my goodness. It just seemed that a simple way of promoting that kindness would be to say that if anybody catching public transport didn't feel comfortable just because of what they were wearing, I would sit next to them so they weren't alone.
And then you proposed a hashtag, hashtag I'll ride with you, meaning that you or others would say, I'm on this bus, I'm on that train, and if you're wearing a hijab, if you're a Muslim person and you're afraid, I'll ride with you. Is that the idea?
Essentially, yes, just so they know that they're not alone. If anything, for any reason, for any horrible reason should happen, they're not alone. Not like that. And I don't think it's just anything that needs to be restricted to Muslims or religious garb. This could go for anybody who has a visible presence which automatically singles them out for attention.
And what was the reaction? When did you realise that this was something that was going to trend, that was going to touch hearts?
It was picked up by a couple of local Sydney people who, after that, it pretty much spread out quickly through Sydney. And it was when my phone wouldn't stop vibrating that I sort of realised that it was gone well beyond me. Mm.
I've seen people who've taken photos, who've made little signs called hashtag I'll ride with you, who've taken selfies of themselves. This is what I look like. Come stand by me if you're scared and afraid. This is actually going to happen, is it? Do you think people are actually going to do this on public transport in Sydney and around the country?
People have already been helped by this. It's already happened. It really has.
What do you know of that? What have you heard?
Basically, just bits and pieces that I've managed to glimpse on Twitter. That's all. Mm. Only what anybody else knows. But it has made a small difference to some people.
Okay. The other hashtag that's gone alongside hashtag I'll ride with you is hashtag This is Sydney. Now, you are actually from Melbourne. That is your secret. You only arrived in the city in April.
I have been asked, yes, I am actually Melbourne.
Is this Sydney? Is this who we are, do you think?
Sydney is the biggest city in Australia. It cannot be summed up in anything that can be put in 140 characters at all. We're complicated and we're contradictory and conflicting, and we just have to live with that. Mm. And that means that we will get sad, angry men who do what he did. And we will also get very tired, frazzled people who will step up and speak out.
And social media means that we don't have to rely on traditional community leaders to call for harmony. We can have people like you and people like the other 120,000 say, well, I'll be a leader today. The New South Wales Premier said, we are a peaceful, harmonious society. We are the envy of the world. And I think you very much helped with that, Tessa. What bus will you be riding this morning?
Well, I won't be going to work this morning, as I did not sleep a wink last night. But if you keep an eye out for me on the 373 between Coogee and Martin Place, I am actually a little bit of a hermit crab, so feel free to say hello, but I'm not a great conversationalist, especially in the mornings.
Tessa, thank you so much for making time for us and for coming out of your hermit shell and speaking to us. You've done a great thing. Good for you.
Thank you very much, Ellen.
Tessa, come. Next, we're taking a look back at the best music from the year past. We've had a whole host of fantastic musicians join us in the breakfast studio. After the news, we'll hear their fantastic performances as captured by the ABC Music team. Time for the news now, 8 o'clock.